Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight we have Charles Ross, author of Inside, a book about murder, forbidden love, high style in a popular magazine, jealousy, betrayal. It's all there. Say hello to Chuck Ross. Hey, Chuck.
Hi, Nate. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm honored to have you. Chuck Ross, as I said, wrote a book called Inside. It is the story about the inner workings of a high-style magazine, especially surrounding a murder. When I first started reading the book, I said, okay, it's like The Devil Wears Prada, except it's a magazine. But it's a lot better because there's this murder, and I love murder mysteries. How about you?
Oh, yes. I've read all of Agatha Christie at least 3 times and lots of others.
What is it about certain people that like mysteries?
I think we like to solve puzzles.
You're right. I do like to solve puzzles.
And I work at least one crossword puzzle every day, so I think that's the other way. It's a mystery how to solve it. I only do the ones that have themes.
Really? Oh, I do Sudoku, so I like the numbers. But you know what I think it is? I think certain people like to know there's an ending. Uh-huh. Like, that's why we're not theologians, because there's no ending to that stuff. Okay, so the book takes place in what is a thinly veiled magazine that is, we know it's Architectural Digest, mainly because I knew it was Architectural Digest by looking at the cover. And as you're watching the screen, as you're listening to this, you're going to see the cover of the book, which to me looks a lot like the cover of Architectural Digest. I'm sure that was.
Well, that was very intentional since I was the art director of Architectural Digest, so... Yes, that's why it looks like that.
How long were you art director?
I started in the magazine in 1976, and I was the art director in 1978 until 1985.
Wow! And and where was Architectural Digest based at the time?
In Los Angeles.
It was in Los Angeles. Okay. So and the book also takes place in 1976-ish.
It starts in 1976. Well, it actually starts in 1981, and then there's a flashback.
Right, right.
And it begins in 1976 and goes back to 1981.
Right, right. And it starts with a lot of classic things. Of course, there's an evil boss and a perfectly sane and witty narrator. Is that correct?
Well, I hope so, but I hope he does have some flaws because you don't want to have a person perfect. But yes. He helps organize the magazine much better. It hadn't been organized well and things like that.
Right. So it's a classic case of good versus evil.
Yes.
It starts that way, of course. But there's a lot of twists and turns, and we'll talk about some of that later. Many times when you go behind the scenes, and people love behind the scenes anything, what can you tell the listeners tonight about what goes on behind the scenes at a magazine that they may not know about?
Well, one of the things is people always used to say to me when they found out I was the art director, they'd say, oh, you do the layout. And they knew that word, but they really didn't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, it means something different now than it does then because everything's done by computer. But back mm-hmm. then, we had to do everything by hand. But the other thing is that Andrew Holleran, in the blurb he wrote about this book, said that it was a biography of a magazine, that the book mm-hmm. was a biography of a magazine. And I think that's really true, that you really go behind the scenes and you see what happens at the magazine. You see how they select the homes that are going to be published. You see how they select which pictures are going to be published mm-hmm. and how many pages and things like that.
Right. And not only that, but also the colors that are used, the typeface, the lighting. I mean, there's more that goes into it than just saying, oh, well, we want a picture of the entry hall, we want a picture of the kitchen. I mean, there's...
That's right.
You know.
And one of the interesting things that happens in this book is that when Anthony, the art director, well, he isn't the art director in the start, but when he becomes the art director, the editor, whose name is Leaf, she wants him to come up with a new way of doing covers that no other magazine is doing, and he does that, which actually I did at Architectural Digest. All, at the time, there was like House and Garden and House Beautiful. There was not, when I worked there, there was not all these interior design magazines as there are today. They all started because Architectural Digest became so successful and they wanted to copy it. But, you know, all these magazines would show a whole room. It was a view of the entire room on the cover. And I decided that I would just show a detail.
Point of view.
And it would be one point perspective, and it would be very tightly cropped. And that's the cover also of my magazine, of the book,
right.
As you pointed out. It has that one point perspective, and it's a very tight shot.
Isn't it interesting? I have no art. I didn't know what I was looking at. I really did not know that I was looking at a one point perspective. I did not know that I was looking at a tight shot. I didn't know that it was, you know, that I knew, all I knew was, that's Architectural Digest.
Yes, right.
So it's a brand, you almost made a brand.
Yes.
You branded the magazine by a visual.
And there are a lot of inside jokes in this magazine that, I mean, in this novel that people won't get, but I got them because I wrote them. But,
okay.
I mean, they're funny. And, like, as an example, there's a photograph on the wall in on the cover, and that photograph is a crotch shot. It's sort of like Sticky Fingers, the album that the Rolling Stones did. It's a crotch shot. And so, to me, that was a play off on the word inside, so that not only are you... do you have a book that's about a magazine called Inside, but you're going inside that magazine, plus you're going inside people's pants because there's a lot of sex.
Right, and that's common in any large organization when you really think it's all business, when you really get behind any inside, you know, when they go inside banking or inside Wall Street, or of course inside Washington, that's a joke. You do see a lot of sex, and you read about a lot of sex. I mean, even you know, William Manchester had to write about sex when he wrote about JFK.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're gonna go right to Lee Radziwill. Okay, I'm making a confession here. I am a Lee Radziwill, like, you know, ogler. I've always thought she was like the classiest thing in the whole world. And there's a mention of Lee Radziwill. Do you want to talk about that a minute?
Well, I actually don't remember too much about what was said about Lee Radziwill in the book, other than that she was designing it. They moved her house from one issue to the other, or they didn't move the house from one issue to the other because it said that she needed work. But I did meet Lee Radziwill in person a couple of times, and she was always very gracious. People, you know, because she was a famous woman, people really put her down and said she was very bitchy, but she was never bitchy to me. She was very nice. She, you know, she sent me thank you notes. I mean, she was a delightful woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I left her office one day, she followed me out to the elevator and she pushed the button, which I thought was very classy of her to do that.
Well, you know, we'll talk about celebrity, but I always thought she was classier than Jackie.
Well, she had a certain aloofness that I think made her appear classy. You know.
More like Grace Kelly.
Yeah.
She was more like a Grace Kelly. Well, you know, I've noticed, and as a longtime reader of Architectural Digest, coming and going, I'm not really, as you can tell by the looks of the apartment you're sitting in, that I'm not really a design freak. But I have read it a few times, and it seems like there's always a celebrity. Not always. Is there always a celebrity?
I think so, because I haven't looked at that magazine for years, but they certainly they probably still do have this feature every issue that's called Architectural Digest Visits, and it visits a celebrity, and you see that person's home.
Right.
And that's the main selling point, you know, that they try to say, we're going to do Brooke Shields or, you know, Sylvester Stallone, who may have horrible homes, but they will sell magazines.
Right, right. I mean, that's the thing. You know, this kind of, well, look at who people know more. They know the names of the Kardashians, but they don't know who their state senator is. Or,
that's right.
Right. So, and celebrity sells, as you said, it sells magazines. And you're right, the taste probably isn't as well. Now, you met the designers, of course, that did some of these homes.
Oh, yeah.
What were they like?
Well, they were all across the board.
Who was your favorite?
Oh, probably Angelo Donghia. He died you know, during the 80s. But he was a wonderful designer. I think he was my favorite.
Was he the one who did all the fabrics?
He did fabrics, but he was very casual in his designs. I mean, they were very carefully planned, but they never looked like they were planned. They looked like it was just, you know, very comfortable, and that's what I liked. It was very relaxed. So he was my favorite.
Okay. Now, you said you lived in Los Angeles for a while. You live in Florida, obviously, now. What are the differences in design between living in Los Angeles in that time and living in Florida now?
Well, I think in Los Angeles, the home was all important. It was, especially Los Angeles, I mean, it is a one industry town, it is a showbiz town.
Right.
And so everybody wanted to know or hang on to the least little celebrity they thought that was important, and they all wanted to have homes that wouldn't be celebrity homes in themselves. I only live in Fort Lauderdale, so I can only speak about Fort Lauderdale, and I would say that there are so many second homes here, although that's changing, but there are so many second homes that people do not devote the attention to their homes that they did in Los Angeles.
I see. I see. And the weather is different here. I mean, it's a different weather. I know. I'm going. Okay. So
I wanted to say that at some point I designed.
I know, I was going to ask you that question. And of course, your favorite designer is yourself.
Well, I did do my own apartment.
I do. He has a gorgeous apartment. I mean, you like walk in the apartment, you go, ooh, okay, go ahead.
Well, that cover shot is of my apartment on
the
book.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Did you take the picture?
Of course.
You took your own picture of your cover? You didn't, like, have a professional? Well, I guess you're a professional.
I'm a professional. Aesthetic.
So you have done interior design?
Yes.
And, for commercial or residential?
For residential. Mm-hmm. And in Los Angeles. And since you said you like celebrities, I'll tell you who my biggest client was. And that was Lee Adler, who is Steven Spielberg's mother. And so I got to design her condominium in Los Angeles.
I've eaten at her restaurant, Milk and Honey.
The Milky Way.
The Milky Way. I knew there was a milk in there somewhere.
Yeah, right.
The Milky Way.
The dairy. Yeah, the kosher dairy.
The kosher dairy. Yeah, that's exciting.
But she doesn't have it anymore. You know, she's probably about 90 years old.
Yeah, I didn't know she was still... I didn't know she was still kicking around with her.
But that was a lot of fun. I mean, like, here's an example of how that job went. The first thing, she told me what she wanted, and I disagreed with everything she wanted, because she wanted it all totally white. She wanted white walls, white carpet, white furniture. And so the first thing I did was bring her the carpet samples. I brought only two, and they were both green. And and I said, here, pick which one you want. And she said, but I want a white carpet. And I said, no, you don't. The furniture will float. You need to have a solid base. And you want a garden. I know from what you said that you want to live in a garden, so we're going to have a green carpet. So pick which one you want. So she picks one, and I said, that's the wrong one. We're going with
it. Yeah.
But we got along very well.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you did. I mean, if you picked the right one, that's great. That's a great. So how long? So you just took a few clients that you didn't really go into this permanently, or did you?
No, I didn't. I just did it. Because I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, it's fun. It sounds like you have fun. Okay. You know, you have lived an interesting life. You have a lot of, I know from working with you at the Stonewall National Museum Archives, you've brought in friends like Chip Kidd and Andrew Hallahan and Edmund White to come speak there. And these are your, like, friends, like people you call up. I mean,
I didn't bring in Chip, but yes. Okay. Andrew Hollerin and Ed White and Felice Picano.
Right. But Chip Kidd did a TED, a real TED. I mean, it's like, I'm excited. You know somebody who did a TED. Anyway, so how long have you known Andrew Hollerin?
Oh, many years. I mean, maybe 15, that long.
And, you know, when you have friends that are like these huge authors. I mean, we're talking about the original Violet Quill. People, most of my listeners do know about Violet Quill. We've talked about it a lot of times. The Violet Quill was a group of people, and I think you mentioned three of them.
Right. Three survivors.
The three survivors. That's right. That's correct. They're the last survivors. These people are like, you know, like little gods in the GLBT
icons. Yeah.
And yet, you just like sent him your manuscript and said, "What do you think?" I mean, well, I would actually have been scared shitless to do that. You can say anything on Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, okay. Well, it was very terrifying to send it. As I sent the manuscript before anything to Andrew Holleran, and he actually read it. He's read both novels that I've worked on twice, uh-huh, and he offered wonderful advice. And the best thing he offered about this one is that in the original document, which was written in third person, he said that Anthony, the art director's character, wasn't really on the page, that he didn't have, you didn't know his inner thoughts. And so I changed it, and I developed that, and I even changed the whole thing to make it first person from Anthony's point of view.
I like that.
So that was a wonderful suggestion that he did. I didn't have a problem asking them about to read the manuscript. I did have, it was daunting to ask them to do a blurb, because mm-hmm, then you're asking them really to say something favorable.
Right.
When you're asking them to read a manuscript, you're asking, you know, say whatever you want, say
right,
it's crap. You
right
want them to tell you all the bad things.
Sure, sure.
So that was okay, but to ask for a blurb was sort
right
of difficult.
So you have no formal background in writing, is that correct, or do you?
Well, I always wrote all the time. And when I worked at Veranda, which after Architectural Digest, and I co-founded Veranda with Lisa Newsom, and that mm-hmm was in Atlanta. And I eventually became the editor of that magazine and
okay
edited all the copy, and
okay
I had my own column and stuff. So I've always written, and
I've written,
for a very, very short time, I had a column in GQ.
Really?
It was the West Coast point of view, because
mm-hmm
it was based in New York.
Oh, I see. Okay, great. Yeah, but you know, but your training has always been in design.
Right. Yeah, that's what I studied in majored.
And where was that?
That was at the University of Michigan.
Oh, okay.
School of Art.
Da, 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 da. Yes, I could do the Michigan type thing.
I couldn't.
I have a lot of relatives that are big M. So we just came back from a big wedding, from a big M wedding, so we know all about that. So who is your favorite author? Who are you reading right now? What's on your nightstand?
Well, I just finished today a book called Of Rickshaws and Rebellion, and it is written by a woman who I believe is 89 years old, and it's about her living in Shanghai when
mm-hmm
she was a child of 11 to 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when I attended a writer's workshop, she was one of the people, and she had read from that
oh
book, and so I wanted to read it now that it's published. My favorite author used to be Truman Capote, but I still like the way he constructs a sentence, but his personality so overwhelmed his writing that
mm-hmm
eventually I just got sick of him. So I
right
don't think I have a favorite writer right mm-hmm now.
Okay. What about music and writing? Do you think they go together?
I can't write with music on.
You can't write with music on? Some people can. Some people only write with music. I've heard, that's why
no
I always ask that question.
I have to have an absolute silence.
You're in absolute silence? Okay, because I always ask that question because I have people who give me an entire iPod playset.
I can't do it. And I get totally lost in writing, and sometimes I will work on a sentence and I look up and, oh my God, a whole hour has gone by and I've only written one sentence.
Uh-huh.
But it's the sentence I want.
There's no time limit on this. You're
right
not paid by the hour. So maybe you're paid by the word, but you're not paid by the hour.
Right.
I think in magazines they pay by the word.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
I don't know if they still do, but they did.
And
yeah,
they don't pay at all now. Yeah. And we're going to talk about that. So, you know, you wrote in you worked in magazines probably in a golden age of magazines. They were still published.
Yes.
Many of them lost money, and the egos of the owners kept them going. But how's all that changed?
Well, I mean, now people hardly ever look at magazines unless they are very classy magazines, because everything's available on the internet. And, you know, for a while that wasn't so advantageous, but now with things like retina screens, it's beautiful images.
Yeah, it is beautiful images.
And so that's what people use, and I don't see anything wrong with that. But I always think there will still be there will be certain things that people will want because they will want to hold it and they will want to possess it and have it on their coffee table. And it's hard to have a Kindle on your coffee table.
Open to the right page at the exact same time. I know I've got a Miami Design magazine on my thing. I don't want to take it off. It's like 6 months old, but I love the cover that matches all my stuff. You're exactly right. But you know, the other thing is paying for it. We just mentioned, you know, pay by the word. There is so much out there that is not behind a paywall, that if you do put a paywall up, how do you feel about that?
I don't quite what you mean by a paywall.
Oh, paywall means like you have to pay $9.95 to see the magazine a month. You have a subscription.
Oh, yeah. Or like you can only look at 10 pages
Correct.
Free.
Correct. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's called a paywall. It blocks you off if you haven't paid.
I think that's real annoying, but I can understand why they do it. How else are they going to make money unless they sell? But the thing is that, you know, it turned out that magazines never made money from subscriptions.
Right.
They only made money from ads. So I don't know why the New York Times has to do something like that, because they're certainly not going to make money from subscribers.
Correct.
They're going to make money from ads.
Right.
And I think that it probably will change when they keep getting more and more advertising.
Right. And as I said, I don't know how they're, you know, it's not just the New York Times. I mean, everybody's doing a, so, and now there's a...
Even the Sun Sentinel haven't helped them.
Correct. I know. I mean, it would be, but you're right. It is, they never, in fact, even when they sold ads, lost money. But they kept going because of the prestige, you know, and I think the New York Times is one of them. I think the family has enough money to keep it for a while. But yeah, but it is interesting. I talk to people about the new finances of all this. And as I said, you know, and publishing has changed. And your book, you published, this was self-published, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. This is
Amazon.
Everybody... used to have a very negative opinion of self-publishing, and now some of the biggest authors out there, Patricia Warren, her last two books have been self-published. Lev Raphael just published his 22nd and 23rd book, all by self-published, and made three times as much money per book. By the way, let me just give you a little background. I'm sure I've said this before, but the average book, when it's done by, like, you know, Random House or Alfred Knopf, if you're lucky, if the author gets $1.50 out of a $25 book, but with Amazon or some of these other Dreamspinner or Goodreads or some of these other publishing houses that also have an electronic reader, it's almost three times as much sometimes.
Yeah, I'm getting $3.30.
Yeah, so you're getting twice as much as Stephen King.
With only a tiny fraction of the readership.
But we, you know, that's just minor, and we don't know if this could just take off. In fact, these blog talk radio shows just do wonders for people's careers.
And then my only hope, I'm not really into it for the money, because I never expected to make money from it. I want to have it as a movie or a miniseries so that I could have Zachary Quinto play my character.
That's exactly the next question. How much of this is autobiographical, and you just admitted it, or didn't you?
I would say that a lot of the things about me are autobiographical at the magazine. Now, maybe not all the sex, but how to put the magazine together, all that is about me. But it is a novel, and none of the characters are completely based on anybody there.
Right.
You know, and even the people whose real names are used, like Joan Collins and things like that, those names are used fictitiously.
Right, you know, in their actions. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, Zachary Quinto would be good for Anthony, I think. But you have, you know, there's other people you have to... But see, you just can't have Zachary Quinto there. You have to have the rest of them.
I'd have Julianne Moore as the editor.
As Lee. Oh, my God. She'd be the best Lee. Okay, go ahead. Anyway, so what's next? What do you have next on your plate?
Well, I've actually finished a very serious book, which is about a father and son who are trying to come to terms or not come to terms in the case of the father about the son being gay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a coming-of-age story, but it's much more serious. But it uses the same character.
Okay.
And so it's not a continuation of this book. It's a prequel because it's when he's younger.
Okay. Is it Anthony as a college graduate or?
No, even younger.
Oh, goes back farther?
Yeah, like I think he starts when he's 8 or something. Like
oh, my
that.
God.
It goes really back.
Okay, so but it's the same characters, but just, you've got a different focus. You're not inside a magazine. You're not
right.
You're not talking about design anymore. You're
no,
talking
it's
about
like how he became who he became.
Okay, that's fascinating.
So that's what I'm working on.
And is that part of autobiographical also?
That's it's much more so.
Oh, that's more so. Okay, well we'll have to be back for another edition of Stonewall Live and Charles Ross. That's hilarious. So as I mentioned earlier, I've known Chuck through his work at the Stonewall National Museum and Archives. What's your position there?
Well, I design exhibits that are on display. Like right now, there's one on mid-century beefcake, and I curate those shows, putting in things from the archives, and I also volunteer in the archives,
mm-hmm.
Cataloging and processing and preserving things.
Good. Well, I'm just going to do a little plug here. You can meet Chuck Ross, or Charles L. Ross, excuse me, live and in person this Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, 1300 East Sunrise Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale. The Stonewall National Museum and Archives is open every day from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday, Saturdays noon to 3. This Thursday's program is free and open to the public, and books will be available for purchase and signing. There'll be a reading, a small get-together, and I'd like to get some of the listeners to come on by because it is a really fun thing to do, is to meet the author, chit-chat and talk, and of course then you get to see Charles, are you Chuck?
Well, the reason the book says, everyone calls me Chuck, but it says Charles because that's the name I use. Professionally.
Okay. Anyway, you can see Chuck's work at the library as an archivist, and Charles's work as an author. So you work in the archives, and the archives is this huge thing, and we always have this argument that they're how much it weighs because I had to pay for the movement, and it's 40 tons of archival material. What do you like most about working in the archives?
I like the history. I like finding out things that I don't know anything about,
mm-hmm.
And discovering people from the past who turn out to be lesbian or bisexual. For example, the woman who created the sculpture at the Bethesda mm-hmm. Garden in Central Park. I mean, I don't think anybody really right. knew that she was a lesbian, and, mm-hmm. and it was amazing that someone at that time, at the turn of the 19th century, designed. Was it the turn of the 20th century? That she designed a sculpture that's so famous.
Right.
I mean, I love discovering things like that.
Well, right. And every so often I will be sitting at the front desk for when I'm volunteering or coming through and Chuck comes out with a quote from somebody that is like hilarious. And he has found, my favorite quote that he discovered is Fran Lebowitz's. On the color of her car.
My car was such a subtle shade of pearl gray that straight men thought it was white.
Yes.
But my favorite quote is Lily Tomlin, which says, "I worry about being a success in a mediocre world."
Well, I mean, okay, that's pretty good. All right. We didn't have any callers, but we still have about 90 seconds if you want to call in. The number is 805-830-8355. Again, that's 805-830-8355. Press 1 to get in the queue. I know how to spell queue. It's Q-U-E-U-E. And so back to Inside, okay? You've explained a lot about it.
Well, I want to say something because you said it was about forbidden love. And although there is this young character in there who's 15 and 16 years old, the art director will not have sex with him until he turns 18. So
right.
it's really, the young kid is having sex, but not with the art director.
Okay, forbidden lust. Okay, I right. said the wrong word. Love and lust are like a thin line. You know, the thing with Jimmy Carter. I'm sorry.
That's so, he preserves the morality.
Right. Okay. When you first saw the book finished product, what did you think?
I was thrilled.
Really? Did you feel? Go ahead.
I just love the cover and the design of it, and I think, oh my God, that comes off as so conceited, you know. But
no,
I think you can recognize it, and a lot of people have like it just because of the cover, because it's so simple.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're waiting for the prequel.
The prequel. Yeah.
Good night from Fort Lauderdale. Thank you.